Welcome to Brave. Be inspired by the best leaders of Southeast Asia tech. Build the future, learn from our past, and stay human in between. I'm Jeremy Au, a VC, founder, and father. Join us for transcripts, analysis, and community at www.jeremyau.com. Hi, Cliff. I'm super excited to have you on the show. You're blockchain world, former founder. You went to Stanford, which is boo. Since we're at UC Berkeley, we had the big rivalry on football game. And I think you have a really interesting story to share, especially about how you are helping fund and build up the next generation of startups as well. And congratulations on your recent fundraise, $50 million from Samsung Next. So love to hear more about who you are and why you're here.
There's no rivalry, Jeremy. Yeah, my name's Cliff Su, one of the co-founders of Multiverse. Really excited to talk about what we're up to.
Tell us more about what was it like growing up? Were you always a geek, a nerd, loved computer science, destined for engineering and technology and founder life?
Actually, no, that's a good question. No one's ever asked me that before. No, I was actually one of those weird kids who actually got a higher SAT score on my verbal than my math. I was going to be an English major, and then my English teacher said, don't be an English major. When I got to Stanford, I realized actually I spent a lot of time messing around with computers and programming, kind of almost unconsciously. I didn't even realize I was doing that. I think my parents must have Miyagi'd me. They bought us like an old Mac Plus and messing around with that. So no, I was actually very much like a kind of wordy person, reading, writing person. I ended up loving computer science and loving especially two things, HCI, which is a human-computer interaction, and the other one is AI or machine learning. And my advisor at Stanford was actually kind of a renowned expert in both. He's actually the same advisor as Sergey Brin and Larry Page had. I think I'm probably his least famous advisee.
Awesome. And what were you like at Stanford? Were you partying? Were you just coding? What were you like in university?
I never thought of myself as like a teacher type or anything, but I actually was a staff member on dorm. And the weirdest thing is that out of that dorm, a lot of our co-founders came. Not even kidding on that. So four of us became co-founders. So I think that those ties you make are very deep. It's also kind of like a cool factor for a startup, because I think a lot of startups, there's a horrible saying that's like, a lot of startups die of suicide, not homicide. They don't get killed by other startups or competition. They die of infighting or internal conflict or internal misdirection. And I think one thing that's nice about knowing your co-founders for so long is that unlike founder dating or some other process, you've known them for so long that kind of whatever drama is going to happen has already happened way back in the dorms or something.
So that means at one point of time, you were playing beer pong with your co-founders, I guess.
Yeah, actually, we ended up, two of us were staff together. And then the next year, one of them became the same staff member I was in the same dorm. That year was very special, I think. Yeah, it's been a good experience. I ended up actually working during school, and I actually experienced my first IPO in school. And I was an intern, but they gave me stock options because they're awesome. So that was kind of a crazy experience for someone in college. I guess you could say I was hooked after that.
What was that like as an intern watching an IPO? Tell us about how that moment made you hooked.
I mean, it wasn't the IPO process, but I think it was just, I was in Stanford and then I was commuting. I was riding the Caltrain up to SF to go work. This was in Soma before Soma kind of just got completely changed over. We're working in an old coffee warehouse, extremely cool company. The VP of engineering there, he just really liked me and he made me an offer. And I found out I was actually the only one who got stock in the company, the only intern. And so I felt really honored by that. After that, we decided that we always wanted to have interns in our company because I think you can make a little difference in someone's life. So we've always tried to hire interns, especially from maybe disadvantaged groups. So right now, one of the interns that we have is actually, he's Latino and he's actually pretty young because we want to make sure that we try to make a difference in their life, that it's very early in their life so that they can actually like kind of maybe change course a little bit earlier. Because if you give someone an internship, they're already like a student at Berkeley or something, just for example, they've already made it pretty well in life. And so we want to start even earlier than that. So we've had high school interns in our companies, which is kind of unusual for a tech company.
Wow. I guess that's a huge difference from a lot of folks, because I think a lot of my founder friends are like, yeah, interns are great in terms of like the fact that they're there, but sometimes they can be a huge hassle to manage.
They don't output anything, let's be honest, like amazing work. but I think it's more giving back into what you can. I mean, I think once in a while they surprise you with something they can do, but when you give an internship to a high school student, the best you can hope for is that you can make an impression in their life that's positive.
Oh, that's really sweet of you, to be honest. Sweeter than most co-founders I know. And then you decide to work at big companies as a result. Well, not really, actually, because you worked at Merrill Lynch and IBM. So what was that like?
I just had this kind of philosophy that I feel like I wanted to learn what it's like to work at a big company before I went to do a startup. Merrill was awesome. I mean, working in Manhattan, just learning about how that side of the world works was super interesting. I did study, I minored in econ. So it was something that I was thinking about maybe doing. And they had great plans for me. They're like, oh yeah, we can like take over this whole part of, they wanted me to go to Brazil for some reason, I think at the time. It was pretty wild and interesting walking across Manhattan every day to go to work. It was just a unique experience. And then I worked at IBM working in the machine learning team for voice recognition. That's when I realized like, wow, these companies have a ton of resources. And then the second thing was, wow, they have a lot of red tape, a lot of overhead. And that's, I think, when I started realizing that one of the biggest, or maybe one of the only advantages a startup has is speed of execution, speed and just kind of clarity of vision. Anyways, I think, yeah, IBM was a great experience. And then I just went into the world of startups.
Amazing. And how did that happen? Because you also went to work at Google as well. And that was actually pretty early, actually, in the day.
Well, our company got bought by Google. I pretty much was out of there at that point. Just the last thing I wanted to work was a big company again. I decided to start my startup right then. I remember getting hauled in by the CEO of the company and the VP of engineering. The CEO is super awesome, amazing guy. The VP of engineering, we'll just call him Steve. He said, Cliff, well, first of all, they're trying to keep me in the company. And I guess one way you can tell if you're valued or not is how many people they haul out to try to retain you. And so the VP of engineering is talking to me. He's like, Cliff, I don't see you as a CEO. Hope I'm not breaking your heart. That's actually what he said verbatim. So I don't know. I didn't really take that like personally at the time, but I was like, okay, well, I guess I have to prove him wrong. I actually see a lot of patterns in startup founders where there are people cheering you on. And then there's also a couple of people on the side who are saying, oh yeah, they were never going to make it anyways. So let that fuel you. And I think you look at a lot of founders, especially the kind of old school, old guard, I guess I should say, successful ones, you know, Larry Ellison, Warren Buffett, Steve Jobs, like a lot of them are adopted. A lot of them or face some kind of rejection when they're very young. Larry Ellison was raised by his uncle. His uncle thought he'd never make it in anything. And I think that extra fuel gives you that kind of unholy drive, I guess, that might kind of carry you through the rough spots. I prefer love over hate, but it's like, you know, whatever it takes. Sometimes you need a little bit of extra fuel to get it going.
I like this dark side of the force starter pack that you just talked about. And it's interesting because there's a lot of emotionality involved with being a founder because you use that to carry that into being your first startup and saying, to some extent, obviously proving yourself, but also proving that CTO wrong. What was that like building it out, your first company?
Oh, we made so many mistakes. It's not even funny. And I think that's maybe one of the ideas behind Multiverse is that if we can just help maybe pass on our mistakes, maybe as opposed to our wisdom, then maybe some people can make fewer mistakes. We didn't take VC money. We took convertible debt initially. And so we were gunning for profitability. And so we hit profitability really, really fast, like within the first year. But the problem, I think, is when you hit profitability so early, especially in a small company, you might actually end up capping your own growth. Like if we had taken VC money instead and just like put a rocket engine on the back of it, and kept growing it out. I'm not saying like 60 million uniques a month is low, but I mean, clearly we're onto something. So maybe we should have taken that road. So there's a lot of ways that you can, I think, skin a cat. And I think that one was one of them, but it's too tempting for it to become almost like this like cash cow. Almost like I don't want to use that term, but like a lifestyle company. Someone once called us that and we were like super insulted because we're like, wait, we're working like 80 hours a week. What kind of lifestyle is that? But the reality is that when you have a company that's turning out large amounts of profit, like per person is like a huge amount, it's very tempting to just milk that as opposed to figuring out how to take it to the next level. Now, I think that that's something that we've learned from those past kind of decisions.
That's really interesting because that's a classic point and rebuttal, which is like, yeah, you know, you should raise VC funding. And everyone's like, no, we should bootstrap. And then people are like, we should bootstrap. No, you should raise VC funding. So tell us more about the trade-offs you think for that dynamic on reflection.
Well, we bootstrapped it. So the first year was kind of funny because I was making like under $40,000 a year that year, which is kind of a little rough in the Bay Area. I remember my banker actually asked me, he's like, how are you paying your mortgage? Oh, you can always try to bootstrap it. I think things are so fast now that I'm not an expert on this, so I don't have a super strong opinion on this, but I'm actually a really strong believer in that, that if you don't have a lot of expertise, you shouldn't have a strong opinion in something. But what I do know is from our data point, bootstrapping, if you don't think there's going to be a lot of competition in your space, maybe that can work. But if there is going to be people on your tail, which I cannot really imagine any business that is going to be high growth without competition, it's very hard to do it without fuel. And VCs also bring a lot more than just fuel. They bring wisdom and experience. And VCs are people, right? There's good ones and bad ones. So, but I think that same with founders. If you find the right match for you, it's probably a lot faster and more efficient to not try to bootstrap it, because you're going to make weird decisions when you bootstrap. For example, we didn't do cloud hosting for a while, a long time, because it was too expensive. Like, we had so much traffic, you know, we're doing like billions of page views. So it's like, we calculated if we did Amazon, it's like hundreds of thousands of dollars per month. So we couldn't do cloud hosting because of that. And so because of that, we ended up spending more time managing servers. And because of that, we spent less time coding and building it. These trade-offs are quite expensive. I don't know if you should make a decision just to avoid taking VC money. It can be quite expensive. It can actually kill the company. But yeah, we got lucky. I do think there's a lot of luck in it. It's a really, really tough trade-off.
If you were to boil down to it, is in what scenarios would it be better to bootstrap versus in what scenarios would it be better to do VC funding? And I think you mentioned one of them, which is competition, which is that if you have less competition, you have time to bootstrap. If you have more competition, you have to move faster. Any other scenarios or things that will push you to recommend one over the other, since you've experienced both sides of it?
Well, this goes back to my not having a strong opinion about something I'm not an expert on. Like, so I think a VC is probably seen this hundreds or thousands of times. I've seen it. I've lived it a couple times. I don't have a super strong thesis on this, but my theory is, like, I remember hearing about a guy who, like, posting on Reddit or something. He's driving a Lambo. People are like, how'd you get a Lambo? And he said, oh, I make software. It's like, what for? I make software for waste control for, like, sewage treatment plants. And it cranks out a ton of cash, so I buy a Lambo. I hope this doesn't get misquoted as an I do not drive a Lambo. but this guy on Reddit, he drives a Lambo because he makes software for waste management for like sewage treatment plants. I feel like for that one, maybe you can bootstrap it, because I just don't see a ton of competition coming in that's going to undercut you and outrace you, outpace you. That would be probably my main guidance. I guess the other one would be, is it a capital intensive company? Is it going to take a lot of cash to build? If you're just making software for waste treatment plants, probably not. If you're going to make rocket engines, it's probably pretty cash intensive. You know, if you're going to make VTOL electric aircraft, you probably need some serious funding, some serious backing.
I would say that was a pitch perfect set of yardsticks, I would say, to push you one way or the other, which is described as one is competitive intensity. The second one is the size of the niche. And the third is the capital intensity of what you intend to build. So I think that's all great. And so there you are. You start to say, I'm going to wrap this up, even though it's kind of like on that steady path, profitability, et cetera. What was that like? Did you feel yourself getting more tired or bored? Or what was it that said, like, okay, instead of keeping going or figuring out how to unlock this to the next stage, okay, I'm going to do something new?
That's a good question. Actually, this is really stupid, but I've done 3 startups. And one of them is a stealth right now, so I can't talk about that one. But that one's quite special. And so I have this kind of obsession with not ever failing. So we actually have pretty big plans for FanPop also, but it's going to come after Multiverse, just because Multiverse is what the world needs now, especially focused on developing countries, especially focusing on people who are unable to access capital, especially in these areas that are really hit by the pandemic, really hit by government instability. It's probably maybe a weak point of mine, which is like better to like sell a company so you can move on. And we actually had a lot of offers to sell FanPop. One of them was from a really, really big media company. It starts with T. What we ended up doing is I wanted to take care of our investors. So we had the convertible debt, remember I told you about. So the first thing I did was spinning off all this cash. So I was like, let's get the investors their returns so that they can enjoy something. And they supported us all this way. It's only right. So that's the first thing I did. And then after that, hired a team of people to help run it. And I think what we're going to probably do in the future is to give some people a stake in the company to help grow into the next level. To me, the very obvious way to next level it is actually going to, of course, involve blockchain. So stay tuned, there'll be more. So we never ended up closing it down, but we do have other people running it. That's a responsible thing to do. The responsible thing to do if you're going to do that is to make sure your investors get their exit, because they didn't sign on for like a 20-year ride. So we took care of them, and then we're able to focus on Multiverse.
Cool. And how did you personally know? Was it to say energy levels, or Was it you went hiking somewhere and an epiphany hit you? I mean, what was driving that? Because I think many founders, for those who hit some level of success, and then they always have to find like that lulls in energy. And I went through those as well, where you're like, I feel less energy now. And so is this temporary versus this is something I should start looking at how to hand over to the next person or someone else or do something new?
I remember watching an interview with Paul Orfalea. He's like the founder of Kinko's. He reveals that he's actually dyslexic, which I think is super interesting. I think it's another one of those challenges that's like Charles Schwab, also dyslexic. And I think these people have these extra difficulties. So they almost have something more to kind of drive them forward. And I remember watching Paul Orfalea say, he's like, do you think I care about your copies and your prints? I can't even read them. Like, you know, I'm dyslexic. I can't read. So do I care about that? No, you know, he did it for the money is what he says. And I think for FamHop, I can't say I did it for the money because I was never sure if we were going to make money. But I can't say that for a long time, I never owned a TV. And so to be a website that's about pop culture, TV, music, movies, it's not really my thing. So AI systems are super interesting. Really, really interesting. The content, while I think is amazing to see the passion of the fans, I could never really share that passion because I could just never get that into Justin Bieber, to be honest. I think that's when I realized for a dude who doesn't own a TV, is it really the best thing to do? And there's another reason, kind of fairly early on in my life around mid-college, I actually had kind of a health scare where I actually had to go and get surgery to get like a tumor removed. And yeah, I wasn't even sure if it was going to be malignant or not. And that was like, the surgery was like painful because I had this weird thing. I think a lot of Asians have this where you metabolize anesthetics faster than, I guess, Caucasian people. And so I'm in the surgery and I'm like, oh, wow, I can start to feel, I'm feeling everything. This really hurts. But I can't like say, I can't stop the surgery, right? So it was a very intense experience, but that wasn't the worst. The worst was at the end. And so they take the excised tumor and they go and do their thing. And I never hear back from them, weeks, months. And I was like, are they trying to soften the blow? Is it because it's not a big deal? What's going on? And finally, I asked my folks who knew the surgeon and they pinged him and he's, oh, I'm really, really sorry. It was benign. You're fine. I was like, oh, okay. During those weeks and months, you're kind of like wondering, should I make plans? Should I not? Like, is this it? I should have never talked about this publicly, but I think that that made me realize like you really shouldn't wait to do something that you want to do because you never know how much time you got. So I think that at that point in FamHop, I was like thinking, well, okay, I don't really watch TV. I don't even know what some of these things are. Song of Ice and Fire. I'm like, what the hell is that? They're like, oh, it's Game of Thrones. Like, okay, I don't have HBO, so it's equally irrelevant to me. I'd much rather be out hiking or something. So that's when I realized like, well, I probably shouldn't wait any longer. And I think I had really good advice from my co-founder, Dave Papandreou. And what he said was, Cliff, take the straight, direct road. You know, just go to where you want to go. Don't take a winding road. When he told me that that year also, I think he had faced a lot of loss. So I think that message has kind of stuck with me. And I think that founders should follow that too, because I actually disagree with Paul Orfalea where, yeah, you could do something for the money, but you're going to hit a lot of rough patches. And if you're not really into it, it's going to be tough to kind of carry through. But if you're really, really believe in what you're doing, then it doesn't really matter. I mean, it still matters. It still sucks to hit rough patches, but you'll be that much more resilient because there will be a lot of rough patches. Like no matter how great things seem to like they're going, being a founder is probably one of the craziest things to do.
Wow, that's deep. I love what you say. At the end of the day, don't wait to do what you want to do. I think that self-discovery moment is huge, actually. What's interesting is that you chose to also approach this from a blockchain perspective and also from funding and startup support. So those are two very different angles. So how did you ideate and come around to this second approach?
Yeah, from our previous startup and also from the Multiverse experience, we realized that actually a lot of times investors get the short end of the stick and founders often feel the same way where they feel like they're kind of both being screwed. And I think that one of the hallmarks of blockchain is, which is very contrary to, I think, what a lot of regulators think, but is extremely transparent. It's indelible, it's transparent, it's permanent. And so I think that's one of the most powerful things about a blockchain. To me, it doesn't make that much sense to run computation on chain or to run a database on chain. I think most people who study computer science would kind of see it as, it's kind of like a write once database. Not like maybe the best place to run a ton of parallel computations or something. But for something that needs to be indelible, that needs to be transparent, it's amazing. And so our idea is when you're an investor, a lot of times all you have is the honesty of the founder and maybe a doc like a SAFT or a safe. And that's all you have. that's kind of between you and them kind of screwing over the investor, and other direction too, where there's a lot of he said, she said. And I think a lot of founders feel that burn also. So our idea is that we write everything goes on chain. Everything from the vesting schedule, the founder, to the lockups, to the actual SAFs and safes, all those things go on chain. And so there's no more he said, she said. There's no question about what you signed up for. And there's no way for someone to like, oops, I drained the whole bank account, bye-bye. You know, it's like, that can happen because everything is controlled by these on-chain smart contracts in our platform. And so there's a very, very fixed vesting schedule. There's ways to get out of those if you need to, but that involves governance of people voting on-chain again. So I think all of those things provide this transparency that is so essential for people to make startups in like a safe way. And as far as we know, I think it's a fairly unique approach, especially given that we allow this to work for startups, for nonprofits, for essentially any organization that's doing this kind of contractual agreement between a funder and a builder.
Why blockchain? So there's so many ways to power this. It could be as simple as, hi, I'm a trusted database and I won't screw you over as a platform, all the way to blockchain. So why that choice as the infrastructure?
I know that I trust my co-founders and I think our investors trust us. But if you're a founder who's using our platform, they don't necessarily know us personally. Same with another investor who's using our platform. They might not know who we are. And really, we look at a trusted database. Let's say it's a central database that's like saying, okay, we're just going to write everything in a database and it'll be fine. And then you look at like Microsoft just got hacked. Like yesterday, I think their cloud database offering just got hacked. In that case, I think they're able to export data. But what if you're able to import or write data into that? So what if data gets corrupted? And then I think an even bigger risk is the human factor. Maybe like in the company, everyone is great. No one's ever going to mess anything up. But you never know. As a company keeps growing, you have more and more linkages, more and more people coming in and out. You hear about like in Tesla, where people are paying people to inject malware into their systems. It's much safer, I think, to have a blockchain that's publicly visible, publicly verifiable. When it's publicly visible and verifiable, then there's this extra level of trust between the founder and the funders, right? We should be transparent. We should be just getting out of the way, letting them work their magic, build their company. And if they have to worry about our database security, or they have to worry about, is someone in the back going to flip a bit so that the vesting schedule goes from 6 years to 6 months, that's something that no founder needs to worry about in our system.
What's interesting about this is that you're making a set of decisions going from point A to point B, which is saying, I'm going to help these people get to the next stage. You're going to be handling these records via a blockchain approach. It's just that from the outside in, a lot of folks that I know are kind of confused. And so from their perspective is, how do you know whether a blockchain startup is legit or not legit? Because there's quite a lot of bad apples we know running around as well. So how do we go about doing from an employee or joiner perspective?
Yeah, that's a kind of like the $1 million question. I think the easiest way to tell is just look at who's backing them, because they can do a lot of due diligence. These are professional investors, they're VCs, they're funds. They've seen like hundreds or thousands of good and bad, from every scam to every top quality company or project. I think that proxy is very powerful. And I don't think that's the only one, because a lot of big VCs backed Juicy Rules. But I think that despite the Juicy Rules of the world, that filter is very, very powerful. There's no reason not to kind of leverage the expertise of those professionals. I've heard of other ones where they're like, oh, they look at their source code or something. There's very, very few people who I think are qualified to evaluate source code for quality, even verifying that it's not just copied from somewhere else and just modified in a little bit. Maybe there are. I mean, I could be wrong. I'm not an expert in this one. But I do think that the strongest filter I can think of is professionals. I would be very hesitant to just rely on what this team looks amazing. The people they list on their team page aren't even on the team. So I don't think that the team page or what they post on their Medium, there's a lot of sophisticated bad players that doesn't really prove very much. But you have to figure that they're investors. They're meeting with them regularly. They're talking to them. They have contracts with them. They're doing due diligence on them. It's a very different level of diligence. I hate to say that's like the only way, because I think, again, I'm a big believer in, if you don't have a lot of expertise in the area, you probably shouldn't have a strong opinion about it. I mean, that's actually the thing we leverage on our platform. We leverage the professional investors as well as advisors. So it's kind of like a pre-filter for people who want to see, okay, well, I don't know much about this space, but man, this VC really knows their stuff and they think it's a good idea. Or they brought up these problems and I agree with these problems.
That's actually a fair point that you raise. I think the difference between startups and blockchain in terms of verticals is It's just that I think the sophistication of the bad apples in blockchain is really the big difference versus bad apples in marketplaces. Pretty obvious in a marketplace thing is like, do you have the transactions or not? Do you have the customers or not? To some extent, there's a little bit of what you talk about is like the arcaneness or the difficulty of also going to the fundamental reality of what's happening. For that, how would you recommend someone to figure out the fundamental reality? Like, how do they get smart? Is that like reading Cointelegraph or... A lot of early stage startups, they may not yet have the legit investors coming in. So they're trying to join a team early. So how do they go about understanding the fundamental business of what they're trying to build? Any books, resources, approaches to get smart quick?
Oh man, I can just list the mistakes that we've made, I guess, maybe for the best way. Definitely, I think you have to be careful who you listen to. So I'm actually a big fan of Ray Dalio's Principles book. He defines as like someone who's believable is someone who's done something successfully three times at least. And I kind of agree with that. Founders, if like they've had one successful startup and then they think that they now can see the future of the universe. And I think that it's not a whole lot of data points. Maybe they're lucky, maybe not. And so when you do try to get expertise from someone, make sure that they've been successful in understanding the space or investing in the space or understanding companies at least a couple times. Hitting it lucky once doesn't really give you expertise. So I would look at the true experts in the space. I think actually the popular media explanations are pretty good. Nathaniel Popper, he writes very well-researched articles about the space. And I think that's a good place to start. Because I think if you go straight to Cointelegraph, it's like, whoa, this is really technical. I'm not sure if I understand all these terms. So I think starting with like New York Times articles and stuff like that, it's not a bad place. It's not a bad place to start. But definitely find those people that aren't just good talkers, but actually have done it a couple times.
How do you think... are some of the myths and misconceptions about blockchain?
There's people who are like security maximalists. Going maximalist is probably not as risky as going fast and loose like famous Twitter people without taking into account like how long is it going to take and how many people can participate in that network. I think those are the things that people forget. You end up with a non-distributed network because only people with super fast connections can actually run a node. I mean, I think the biggest myth is that there's a lot of misunderstanding about what blockchains can be good for and what they're not necessarily good for. I remember like in 2017, 2018, there was a lot of kind of just run everything on blockchain. And a lot of big companies were guilty of this too. They're like trying to kind of catch the wave. There's a need to separate the kind of marketing hype from what's actually possible from like a computer science standpoint. I think the other one I would also say is a big myth is that I think a lot of projects feel like they need to have a lot of technobabble in their project to make it seem like very technical and very almost like obfuscated. I don't think that's necessary. I think it's actually better if things are more easy to understand. We're still trying to figure out that balance ourselves. We're definitely not innocent of that sin. The good news about our team is that we do at least know that we don't know a lot of stuff. And so we're really open to learning. I think those two things are the things I see a lot of. And then I guess there's also this final one, which is kind of like meme ideas, meme-powered tokens. Because they're not powered by something that's kind of fundamental, they don't tend to last.
What's interesting is that you touched on a whole bunch of different myths, and that reminded me of another point of view from a friend that I'd love to get your point of view on. And I think the way that she articulated it was, at one level, there's all this stuff that's about infrastructure. So building infrastructure for what's the value that can be created. And so that's there. And then there's stuff that has economic value, which we're trying to figure out. Can this be done on a blockchain? Or is this better or 10x better because of a blockchain? And people are figuring that out, which is fair. And then there's a big chunk, which is there's no economic value. So everyone's kind of scratching their head a little bit. And so that's how she articulated that box. And I kind of laughed a little bit because that's like the outside in box. I think one of the tricky parts is that there's also a huge amount of like funding velocity because a lot of the cash flow for blockchain is coming internally from the blockchain ecosystem, which doesn't respect, frankly, the traditional gatekeepers of capital, like you said, VC and legit people. And so these people who are new gatekeepers or new nodes of legitimacy and signal are also kind of like different or less clear from other people's perspective. So how would you think about that?
Well, I think there actually is respect for the traditional gatekeepers. The only data point I have is really our own project, I think. I talked to people and I've asked them, I was like, why did you back us? And they're like, well, the main reason I backed you is because I know that these other funds, they're smart. But at the same time, I do think that there's a need for democratization of it. Because if you look at the whole GameStop, AMC, all these things, there's this desire to kind of like to stick it to these kind of big hedge fund people, which I totally get. Having worked at big banks, I think a lot of those people are actually really great, really wonderful, nice people. But at the same time, I can see that it's frustrating. I hate to say it, but the system is set up in a way to really, really give private equity and maybe to a lesser degree hedge funds like insane amounts of tax shelters and protections that normal people don't get. So I can definitely understand the sentiment. I want to stick it to the man. I don't think it's like as much about sticking it to the man, in my opinion, because the saying is like, don't hate the player, hate the game. If the game is set up in a way to favor carried interest, then funds are going to be set up to exploit that, because otherwise they're just be paying twice as much tax. And of course, they play a hand in shaping those policies. But anyways, I digress. The point is that I think people want to at least have a level playing field. I think that that's the key part, right? People don't want to be like getting leftovers after the big funds are kind of done with things. And actually, that's kind of the fundamental premise of our platform, is that VCs and ordinary people can support a project at the same time. They don't have to like get the leftovers after the VCs are done with all their rounds. And I think that that kind of collaboration is pretty powerful, because if you look at the power of the Reddit community, or look at the power of the short squeezers, they have incredible power when they think alike. And that kind of market moving power, I think, is something that professional investors should probably look at also. So I think to have that collaboration, it's not just regular people learning from the VCs. It's the other way around as well. VCs learning from like what regular people want, what regular people are feeling, and the sentiment of the community. I think it's really, really powerful. That's the entire premise of our platform, really. It's just like leveling the playing field. It's not to give an advantage to one or the other. We're not like blocking out VCs either. But let's be honest, if a VC wanted to create an account on our platform or Sybil an account, they can still do that. So we can't like block them out anyways. You could just register as an individual. So I think why not kind of create the synergy between these two groups and realize that we're all people and we're all actually just excited about startups. And so why don't we learn from each other instead?
Wrapping things up, could you share with us a time that you have been brave?
Man, I was hoping you'd forget this question. I think that what I did to quit a great paying job with a stock and was going to turn into like Google stock, I think a lot of founders have done that. I don't think it's that exceptional to leave something that seems like a sure bet. I did finish school. I didn't drop out. So I didn't do any of those crazy things. I can tell you, how about this? I'll tell you a future brave thing I'll be doing in the next 75 days. So I don't know if it's brave. It's maybe more just crazy. I've kind of realized that I've started living like a maximalist life. What I mean by that is like the opposite of minimalist. Anyways, yeah, without going into too much crazy detail, at one point I was living in Palo Alto. And then I had two other homes that were not being used. And I was like, this is getting kind of ridiculous. And so in about 75 days, I'm going to be vacating my home. We're going to let some other people who are maybe slightly less fortunate live in those homes. My wife and I are going to pack everything that we need into carry-on bags and become nomadic. And I'm going to go and visit all the founders on Multiverse, capture their story. I mean, most of my luggage is going to be like camera equipment. Some clothing, of course. It's not something I've ever done before. I used to travel a lot when I was younger. I think that's actually what made me realize that there's a lot of smart people out in the world who just need better access to these startup tools. So yeah, that's what I'm doing soon. And we're going to do it in the middle of a raging pandemic, which I heard is either a great time to travel or completely insane. Yeah, next time you'll see me, I'll probably be in Southeast Asia or something like that and interviewing some cool founder who's trying to make change the world.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Clear, for sharing all of that. I'd love to wrap things up by sharing the three big takeaways I got from this. The first, of course, is thank you for that very frank professional and personal view on bootstrapping versus VC. There was a strong set of articulation around the fact that you were successful in bootstrapping it, and also you felt trapped by that success versus what could have been in terms of pushing harder and faster for more growth, especially with such a strong set of foundations. And to some extent, the dark side of bootstrapping, which is a super advanced form of having a good business. So most people never get to see that side. I think it's interesting to just share that so that people are aware. And it's also interesting that you're building this new startup that is using venture capital to go for the next stage. And we talk a little bit about some of the legit signals and folks that provide some level of authority and legitimacy in the space as well. The second, of course, is thanks for sharing about blockchain myths. I had a great discussion about how you got into it and why you're building the multiverse.ai in terms of helping other founders with a blockchain approach. I also enjoyed, I think, a little bit of a conversation about how to differentiate between good blockchain teams versus sophisticated bad players. I don't think we really got into enough detail there because it's hard for everybody, even for sophisticated folks, to understand. And I think there's a lot of good references that you've referred people to for reading materials or how to think about a problem, including seeing who are the people who are backing them as well. And lastly, I love the philosophy that kind of like permeated the entire thing and conversation, which is, I'll paraphrase it as, don't wait to do what you want to do. That realization after your personal health, your epiphany there and making a decision to move to the next company, but also how you just articulated that in a different way, your story about bravery, about leaving to build a company and using some of the dark side of the force, but also more recently in the next 75 days about don't wait to do what you want to do, which is to travel and live a simpler life based on experiences. So thank you so much, Cliff, for sharing everything with us.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for doing this podcast.
Thank you for listening to Brave. If you enjoyed this podcast, please share this episode with friends and colleagues. Sign up at www.jeremyau.com to discuss this episode with other community members in our forum. Stay well and stay brave.